Dr. Bill von Hippel is a social psychologist specializing in evolution. He's the author of The Social Leap, which reveals how major challenges from our past have shaped some of the most fundamental aspects of our being, from leadership and innovation to aggression and happiness. He was a guest on the Joe Rogan podcast and does work with the Australian Defence Force. I had the good fortune of having him as a professor while completing my degree in psychology in Sydney, Australia. Dr. von Hippel is the man to speak to if you want to understand why humans behave the way we do, or more importantly, if you want to understand the underlying instincts and impulses that drive violent behavior in our species. Evil thrives when good men and women do nothing, when they fail to make a stand. This podcast is about giving you the tools and the information to make that stand. I'm Ron Engelman, Master Sergeant, Krav Maga Black Belt, IDF combat veteran, proud Jew, and grandson to Holocaust survivors. This is the Ron Engelman Podcast. So how does the Jewish Prussian family end up in Alaska? That's a good question.
So my father's father is of Prussian landowner heritage. That's the von Hippel part, right? Obviously not a Jewish name, very Germanic. But my father's mother was Jewish, and my mother's family is all Jewish. And so when my father went to his father-in-law, my great-grandfather, to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage, because of course this was a long time ago, it was the 1920s in Germany, and my great-grandfather was like, this is not a really good time to be marrying a Jewish girl. But my grandfather, you know, was not to be deterred. And so he ended up marrying her. And they must have got married in around 29 or 30. And then in 33, as you probably know, Hitler fired all the Jews. And that was, if you're a state employer or state employee, which all academics are. And so that meant firing all the Jewish professors. And so at that point in time, although he's not Jewish, his wife is, and the writing is on the wall, and he feels that he needs to leave. And so they were able to find a job in Turkey. And so he lived in Istanbul for 2 years teaching. He's a physicist teaching physics there. And then he that didn't work out long term. So then they went to Denmark, and they were a few years in Denmark. And that probably would have been by around 37 or 38, they were able to get a job in the States. And so my grandfather brought his family over to the US. My mother's family was leaving at around the same time. Coincidentally, she was in Vienna at the time. And so my father grew up in Boston, Massachusetts. And when he got married to my mom, you know, their family's very typical Jewish family, very nosy in-laws. And my father just wanted to get his way as far as possible from all the Jewish relatives who were in his business all the time, as far as he was concerned. And so he had dreamed of setting up, he's a doctor, and had dreamed of setting up a practice in Alaska. He's a heart surgeon, and there wasn't any heart surgery there. And so he thought it'd be a perfect place to be. And he loves the outdoors. So in 1965, we moved to Alaska. I was only two. And so that's where I grew up.
I think I want to start off. I want to ask you, we're going to talk about violence in a second, mm-hmm. but I want to ask you first, maybe the last question that you should be asking an evolutionary scientist. From the Stoics perspective, the question would be, how does one lead a good life? Or if we want to kind of unpack that, it's, you know, what should we do to be happy or content? And obviously the reason why it's not a natural question to ask, because from a evolutionary standpoint, our genes couldn't care less about us being happy. That's not really the point. The point is to pass on the genes.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair question. Yeah, on the one hand, you're completely right that our genes don't care if we're happy or not, right? They just care about procreation. But on the other hand, our genes, you know, we have to evolve attitudes that serve in our genes' best interests. And so the attitudes that we evolve reward us when we do things that are in service of our inclusive fitness, you know, that benefit our genes and the genes of our family. And they punish us when we do things that harm our inclusive fitness. And so the simplest example is that if you eat something that's loaded with fat, sugar, and salt, well, those kinds of foods were rare in our ancestral environment, and so they're delicious. You've evolved to find them super tasty because they're going to make you happy whenever you run into them, and that'll cause you to eat more of them, and so you'll do what's in your gene's best interest. Similarly, if you accidentally ingest dog feces, it's disgusting, and you're going to feel sick or be sick, and so you feel sad, you feel unhappy, and so happiness is literally an emotion or a motivation that evolution gave us to nudge us to do the things that are in our genes' best interest for reproduction and successful raising of children, and to stop us from doing the things that stand in the way of those interests. So what that means is the best way to lead a happy life is to try to do the things that we evolved to do in order to be successful, like partnering up with somebody in a long-term sexual relationship because that's the best way to raise kids. Ideally, a person you find compatible and can get along with, having a family, having lots of close friends, getting together with people to eat good meals. All those are the kinds of things that made us a success in our evolutionary past. And so they tend to make us happy today.
The common approaches from morality or from philosophy, which would answer that, you know, to live a good life would be to live a moral life, to contribute to your community, to get back from it. That's kind of when you go to the classic philosophers who talk about this subject. And it seems that that's where you're pointing as well. There is, I guess, the mismatch, and I'm definitely not, let's say, advocating such a thing, but from a genetic perspective, you could think that maybe, you know, somebody like Genghis Khan, who went around, you know, pillaging a large proportion of the world and raping and passing on his genes, from a genetic standpoint, you could say that he was a genetic success. That being said, in our common society, I can't imagine a life like that. There's got to be some sort of pathology. Right. That just the way that culturally, you know, the values that we absorb culturally?
You raise a good point, which is that you could be an evolutionary success by being a nasty prick or by being a lovely guy. Now, in truth, it tends to be a more successful strategy to be a lovely guy, to be a cooperative, friendly, helpful person who contributes to your community, because in fact, that's why everyone would value you and want to keep you in their group, because if they toss you out of your group, you're not going to survive. And so there is an intersection between the moral purpose and the moral goals and these evolutionary ones. But what I would also say is that we also respond to the incentives in our environment. So Genghis Khan's a really lovely example. If he were trying to go through the world right now, raping and pillaging and slaughtering, he would find that he would probably end up in prison pretty rapidly, right? We live in a world where that's no longer a route to success. And the clearest example of that, I think, is Scandinavia. You know, the Norwegians used to be Vikings. So 1,000 years ago, they were raping and pillaging and murdering, and they were a very big success for doing so. 1,000 years later, when we look at bones from 1,000 years ago, we can see that genetically, they're the exact same people as they were then, the Danish, the Norwegians, et cetera. They're the same genes now they were 1,000 years ago, but they're some of the most peaceful people on Earth and the most cooperative and the most helpful and all that sort of thing. Well, obviously, they've built this really lovely society that no longer rewards you for doing these horrible things. And so that causes, you know, humans are really good at responding to incentives. There's still going to be random psychopaths who shoot people, but most everybody else is going to go along with what provides the most likely access to that reward. And the same person who would have been a Viking 1,000 years ago probably now runs, you know, IKEA or something like that today. So we're really good at responding to incentives. And what that means is that if you devise your society correctly, then you can put people in a situation where violence becomes way less likely, even though we've all inherited a proclivity to be violent.
Okay. So I guess what you're saying is that context really matters. It's about the environment. Mm-hmm. And also there's maybe the thing, we tend to focus on examples on the far end of the bell curve, where they're the exception, exception to the rule. Also, maybe times in history where things like this were possible, but they were also the let's say most people that had the proclivity or had the behavior as Genghis Khan throughout points of history weren't in the right social status, didn't have the power, didn't have the physical capacity, and generally would be ostracized from their group or stoned. So these people didn't tend to survive. But one out of a million, or actually one out of a few billion, that tends to be a genetic strategy. But for most of us, and for this point in history, absolutely not. So what you're saying is, don't go out raping and pillaging. It's not a good.
Well, it won't be a success story. It's not a good idea.
No, absolutely, absolutely not. So I recently finished your book, and I guess one of the big things. So humans have huge brains. We have compared to our body size compared to, you know, in the animal kingdom, and generally, most of the animal kingdom didn't choose to do that. It's not necessarily the best, because one would argue, okay, if that works so well, why doesn't everybody do it? Why why didn't all the? But it's generally not such a successful strategy in the animal kingdom. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. So you have to ask yourself, well, what would big brains get me? And big brains are metabolically really expensive. And so if you're going to try to evolve or develop a large brain, you have to somehow pay the rent on that large brain that you're developing. And so imagine a zebra, for example. It's Albert Einstein in there. You know, what good is it going to do it? Maybe it could have conversations with other zebras that are fascinating, but it's got hooves. There's no tools that it can make. It eats grass for a living. How much is a big brain going to help you eat extra grass? And so there's nothing that a large brain in a zebra could do to make that zebra more successful. But there's a lot it could do to make it less successful, because although it could have great conversations, it's got to eat a ton of grass to support all this extra brain that's not really helping it make a better living. And so animals tend to get as smart as will help them, but no smarter than they kind of need to be, just because they otherwise have to find a way to pay the rent on that extra brain. Now, as you go into different classes of animals, primates are smarter on average than the great cats and dogs and things like that. So obviously with the evolution of hands and now tool manipulation and things like that, you can get to a point where greater brain would help you. And so nonetheless, you still get to a point where a chimpanzee, you know, if you're not a human, given that all the other branches of the hominins had died out, if you're not a human, the next smartest great ape is basically a chimpanzee or a gorilla, and their brains are way smaller than us. And so we know that something really important happened between us and our chimpanzee cousins over the last 6 million years to lead to a massive brain expansion in us and not in them. And I'm happy to go into it, but the basic argument is that we started cooperating and working together better, which allowed us to use our big brains to make plans, to start things like division of labor and planning a hunt and things that could actually bring in more calories in order to pay the rent on that larger brain that we now have. And then it sets off this runaway process where we just get smarter and smarter and can do more and more crazy things with it.
Okay. So why is it helpful for us to have such a, you know, what led? So at some point it was a benefit, but then I guess genetics doubled down on it. From some point when it became helpful, the genetics said, this is really good. Let's continue passing on. I put it as if it was a conscious decision. It wasn't. It was random mutations that proved to be helpful. Right. And then, so why then did it, once I guess you hit a critical load of brain mass in the right, skeleton in the right body, the right brain, it goes, this is really good. And then the brains got bigger and bigger. Why?
Right. So we don't know exactly how and why it happened, but what I believe is going on, and the argument I make in the book, is that around the time of Australopithecines, so around 3 million years ago, we'd moved to the savannah. We had, over the 3 million years since we moved to the savannah, we had developed an upright posture, and that upright posture allowed us to rotate our body in a way that a chimpanzee can't do. Now, that turns out to be important, because when you can rotate your body and when you have the flexibility that a sort of laterally oriented organism does, that's a bipedal walking on two legs organism, for the first time in our ancestry, it opens up an opportunity that never existed before. And that was the capacity to kill at a distance. Now, this is the single most important military invention of all time, because once you can kill at a distance, a larger force of weaker individuals can successfully defeat a smaller force of stronger individuals. And if you can't kill at a distance, you would never do that. So imagine that you and, you know, you, me, and 20 of our closest friends want to attack a lion, and all we have are knives. Well, we're all going to be arguing about who goes first, because you know whoever goes at the first person to jump on a lion and stab it is going to end up in the lion's mouth. It's going to be lion food. Probably the second, third, fourth, and fifth too. And maybe by the sixth person jumping on top of it, we'd have a shot at killing the thing. But nobody's, it's never going to happen because nobody's going to go first. But once you can kill at a distance, and in the case of what Australopithecines could do is they could throw. So now they could throw stones. And once you can do that, and therefore you can attack a target from a position of relative safety, now if there's 20 or 30 of us and a lion comes toward us, we just pick up rocks and pelt it. There's nothing it can do to get at us because we're still a long way away and we're doing a great damage if there are enough of us throwing at the same time. And so we don't have records of their behavior, but if you look at all the different pieces of the puzzle, they line up to suggest that in all probability, it was around the point of Australopithecines who started throwing. And then because they started throwing, they developed the psychological proclivity to work together, because throwing doesn't do you a lot of good if everybody else runs and I'm standing there throwing rocks. You know, the lion's going to eat me and it's going to be mildly annoyed. But if all of us throw stones at it now, we could drive it away. And so somewhere along the way, they must have discovered that. And then it completely shifted our psychology. We're way more cooperative than chimpanzees are. And from there, we see a dramatic increase in our brain size as it moves on to Homo erectus, who now have all the skeletal parts are perfectly in place to be very effective throwers. And by the time we get to Homo erectus, which is 2 million years ago, we can now see evidence of planning for the future, which we can't see before that. We can see evidence of division of labor, which we can't see before that. So these bigger brains that they started to develop from around Australopithecine time, probably by as an offshoot of being bipedal and banding together and cooperating, now gave them a reason to get smarter and then gave them benefits from getting smarter. But even since Homo erectus, you know, we're adding basically another chimpanzee brain on top of theirs. So there was massive change in the last 2 million years as well.
It's interesting because, the body mechanics are completely different. I remember as a kid, you used to watch the kung fu movies and everything. And you had, crane kung fu and praying mantis, and you had, the tiger. But if you go into it, it's nice for inspiration. But if you go into it, you understand that the human body is shaped very different. It's also shaped different from a chimpanzee. Like you see gorillas and chimps fighting in the wild. Actually, I don't know. I don't know on this one, because if you look at an untrained human, the way that that we naturally fight is, let's say, it's also, by the way, very interesting. There's differences in natural fighting reactions between men and women. Men will close their fist and will kind of throw big haymaker swings at each other. The natural reaction tends to be to grab with one hand and to kind of swing a closed fist, not as a punch, but as kind of like a club. To club another one to death. Women tend to use nails and biting and things like that much more naturally. And I've got kind of a theory about that. It's because and maybe you can either back it up, completely dispel it, or add on top of that, where men fight for a variety of different reasons. Men can fight for territory, for mating rights, for resources, and not everything needs to be a fight to death. Actually, on the contrary, most things doesn't serve as evolutionary to completely kill the person that we're fighting, especially if it's not somebody from, let's say, part of our social group that we interact with. On the other hand, when women fight in the human species, it's generally to protect the young or to protect their lives. And that's why, I mean, if you go to particularly bad nightclub, I've actually been some in Queensland, where you're at the moment. We've got a few shady ones in the Gold Coast. You see, when the guys go at it and when the girls go at it, it's completely different. The guys will throw some punches, and if one guy gets knocked on the ground, people will generally back up. It's becoming less and less of the case, but that's how it used to be. And when the girls fight, it's like all bets are off. It's nails, the shoes come off. It's really a different level of, I kind of also use that to kind of that from a self-defense perspective, women, if they can reach into their instincts, their survival instincts, they have much stronger fighting survival instincts than what men do. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would agree with you that there are very different reasons why men and women typically fight. So men commit the most of the homicides, and they're also most of the homicide victims. But the same holds for aggravated assault and all these different kinds of things. Now, of course, the rules are different when you have domestic violence, that is men and women fighting each other and who are partners. But setting that issue aside, although I'm happy to chat about it if you want, the motivation for fighting is actually quite different. And as you point out, you know, conspecifics, members of the same species, basically don't want to come to blows with each other because all they really want to know is, well, who's going to win? And so if you and I are in a bar and we're arguing about a girl or a seat or a beer, I just want to know, like, I want to get in your face and then you get in my face and I go, Ron looks a little tougher than I am. Today he wins. He can have the seat or the beer or whatever it is we're arguing about. And you're happy with that too, because even if you beat the crap out of me, you're still going to have sore knuckles when the whole thing is done. And so you've gained nothing from it and you've suffered some potential losses. And you see that across the animal kingdom, there's a lot of posturing. In some animals, it's very ritualized, where I tap you and you tap me so we can just see who's going to win. And then unless they're perfectly matched, they go their step. One runs away or is deferential and the other one's in charge. Human males are the same way. We fight about the same kinds of things that other animals do. And so really what you're trying to do is just establish winner and loser. And then most time it's over, not always, of course. But when females fight, as you point out, there's different motivations for it. And so it can go longer or shorter, depending on what the circumstances are.
That's an interesting point you raise about the posturing, because, you know, traditionally people think about violence as responses to a violent threat, as fight or flight. That's generally the model that, mm-hmm. that people discuss. If I'm approached by something that's a danger to me, I'm either going to deal with it violently or I'm going to turn around and run away. And that model doesn't seem to hold as well for fighting within the species. For example, if I'm approached by a lion, I'm generally going to run away. Or if that's not an option, then, you know, I pick up a rock or a stick or whatever it is, and, you know, I say my prayers.
Try your best.
Good luck for me. And one would think it should be the same, you know, in between humans, because if we, and I think that the bar scene is not the right context to think about self-defense, and I'll talk about that in a second. But generally, if I'm approached by some person who wants to assault me, then you would think that the best result would be to turn around just to run, not even to have words. Somebody comes and says, hey, why are you looking at me funny? Or you spilled a beer on me. The safest strategy would just be to turn around and run on the spot. The likelihood of them pursuing you is close to zero, even if you're not a great runner. So that seems the less risky strategy. The second best would be also not to say a word. The moment you understand that they have intention to attack you, is to throw your best punch or to pick up a pool cue or to pick up a glass and smash it through their head and before without any warning.
Right.
But if you look at situations, the likelihood of the best responses for survival, you would think, are zero. Like, you never see that happening. You never see one man challenging another guy and they turn around and run. That's where the model comes in, where we speak about fight or flight is there, but it's much more common to either posture to say, I was looking at you. You got a problem with that? And to meet threat with threat, or to submit, to say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I wasn't looking at you. Can I buy you a beer? Let's settle this. Or I'm leaving, to kind of verbally submit to the person so that they, in the hopes that they don't attack you. So
yeah. So I would say that when two random folks meet each other, that's basically how it goes down, right? So that I see you in a bar, we have some random reason for conflict. You threaten me, I either try to threaten you back and hopefully get you to back off, or I mollify you. And that's probably happens 90% of the time. But if it's intergroup violence, and so it's your group against mine, which is very common in our evolutionary history, then all those different rules are off and off. And you might attack me without warning, and I might be, and if I sense that you might attack me, I might counterattack, so to speak, without warning. And the reason for that is that, again, if you and I are randoms, we're not on opposing groups, both of us don't really want to fight. We just want to know who would win and who would lose. And hopefully we can come to that conclusion without any physical conflict. But if we're members of different groups competing over resources, well, then maybe your goal really is to exterminate me so you can have my resources. Maybe it's not, but I have to treat it like it probably is. And so suddenly it ratchets way up. And even if we're relatively inexperienced, we're much more likely to dive straight into conflict than we are to do all that posturing if we see it as a real strong intergroup situation. Sometimes you could still diffuse that in the same way, but sometimes you can't.
For me, the matter and like the advice I give people is, you know, if you're confronted by someone who wants to fight you, is just turn around, walk away, like run if you can, or just turn around and walk. If you're looking at somebody and I mean, look, if we're looking at evolutionary perspective, we'd say that, you know, you can sense that they're bigger than you and that you don't have a chance. Or if we're looking at modern day, you said there's nothing to be gained here for getting into a fist fight with the person in front of you. You don't know if they're going to pull out a knife. You don't know if you're going to punch them so hard that they're going to land on the concrete, break their head, and then you're going to go to jail. So there's nothing to be gained here. And the advice would be if somebody walks up to you and says, hey, you know, let's fight or push it, is just to turn around and walk away on the spot, not to engage, not to talk. Why is that so hard?
Well, the reason it's so hard is that we also evolved quite broadly in what are now often referred to as cultures of honor, where my reputation is super important. So if you rock up to me in the bar and you say, and you could be a stranger, I've never seen you in my life, and you push me and say, you know, come on, let's fight or something like that. If I don't put up any resistance at all, then ancestrally, I would be marked as now Bill's weak. Everybody can push him around and take whatever he has. And so the reality is that in today's world, I'm in a bar. I don't know anybody. I don't know you. So my reputation doesn't matter. I could run away and tomorrow I'll go drink at another bar and nobody even knows it happened. But we didn't evolve in this context of strangers. And so our psychology is still a psychology where we expect to have to deal with these people again. And so if you come up and you push me around and want to take my beer or something, I might actually be better off throwing a few punches, even though you're going to kick my ass, because at least it was a little costly for you. And next time you want to still take somebody's beer or push them around, you think, well, I beat Bill, but it hurt. I'll go with that guy over there. And so we kind of evolved to defend our honor, so to speak, because we lived in a lawless world, you know, where people would have their way with you if you let them. And so you have to at least make it somewhat costly. You know, my elementary school was the exact same. So even though I'm a little tiny guy, every once in a while I felt like, well, I better duke it out with this person because I know I'm going to lose, but at least I'll make it not worth their while to instigate it again.
Yeah, that sounds like very good advice, you know, to children. That it's funny, the children's society, it's very different from the life we lead as adults. And I'm sure we could do a deep dive into that, but it seems to me that there's more consequences to actions. I can, like, if somebody is going to assault, it depends on the society. You rightfully spoke about, and maybe we'll talk about later about different cultures, because me here in Israel, we have touches of Western society. Israel is a Western democracy, but on the other hand, it's also the Middle East. So we also understand, you know, more of a tribal society as well. But it seems like in Western countries, I know that if somebody is going to assault me, somebody is going to rob me, I don't have to defend my honor. I'm going to go to police. I'm going to file a report. You know, different places, maybe the police and the system can be counted on more. But I know that the system is going to act for me. Therefore, I don't need to. But as a child, you know, go tell the teacher, maybe things have changed since when I was a kid, but that doesn't really solve anything. You got to make it costly.
This is exactly what the political philosopher Thomas Hobbes was talking about when he says the three big reasons for violence: you want my stuff, and so you attack me. I'm worried you want my stuff, so I attack you preventatively, or we get in this endless cycle of revenge. And when you have a strong government, this, you know, we call it the Leviathan, then you've got this third party who's indifferent and who will enforce all those rules. And so if you try to mug me, I can just run away. And if I can't successfully run away, I'll give you my stuff. But then I'm going to go to the police and I'm going to say, and this is what he looked like, and he's got my stuff. And so somebody will intercede. And that's a huge part of the reason why our societies in general are so much less violent, that I don't have to defend myself anymore. If you come to me in a bar, I don't have to punch it out with you in order to prevent other people in the bar from attacking me. Because as you point out, like if I do successfully punch it out with you, I could end up in trouble because I did more harm to you than was, you know, warranted by the situation I was in. And so we've moved really strongly away from those situations. But again, little kids still kind of live in this primitive landscape often, where if they don't stand up for themselves, they'll constantly be picked on by the bully or whatever. And of course, little kids aren't very strong. And so when you tell your kid, oh, if he does that, punch him back, you don't worry, they're going to accidentally do real damage to somebody. You just know, well, somebody will end up with maybe a bloody nose, and then that'll be that.
Yeah, you see it, of course, in fighting, where, you know, in the smaller weight classes, knockouts and you know, see, are much less common, where in the heavyweights, you see a lot, you know, the punches pack a lot more and have more ability to do damage. Yeah. Kids, you know, throwing punches at each other, while it's definitely not something great, the capacity right. for injury is smaller than when adults do. And also their bodies, you know, kids, I remember... A couple of years ago, I saw some kid running out near the museum. I think it was in Sydney, and he jumped on a bench, which was a bit wet, and he went feet up, head down, landed straight on his body crunched up in a bit, and he just kind of picked himself up. His parents didn't quite see, so he didn't have a reason to cry. So he just kind of shook it off, ran up to them. And I'm thinking right. of that, and I'm like, if that was an adult, they'd be in hospital for right. 6 months at least.
Yeah. So, yeah, we weigh more, and so we have a lot more momentum, and we're creakier. We're not as rubbery as they are.
Yeah. But there's a flip side to what you said as well, in terms of the, you know, of exacting a price or honor. And that kind of fits in with something that I've been discussing a lot, where when you're skilled in violence, and maybe it's not so much skilled, but you have the confidence. To engage violently, and the kind of the paradox is that people who can defend themselves rarely have to. And I always say that, you know, if somebody walks up and pushes me or even throws a punch, I'm conditioned to it. Like, I get punched on a regular basis in training by people who are really, really good at punching people in the face, and I do that for fun. So it is a different context if it happens, you know, out on the street. There's the social elements to it. But when somebody pushes me, if somebody slaps me, somebody throws a punch, I don't skip a beat that much. But there's also the factor of that if you're skilled and confident in these domains, you're less likely going to have to defend your honor, because you know that, like, you have nothing to prove. Not to anybody, not to yourself so much either. It's not quite a challenge. And it's more capable to kind of back down and save face. It's kind of like, you know, when the baby lion, you know, pulls on the beard of the full-grown adult lion, it's not a threat. It doesn't need to right. respond violently. Sometimes he'll, you know, playingly swipe them away, but it's not something that demands a response. Same thing, you know, if you're right. if you take it to prison, or if you take it to, you know, some chieftain in some society, and they're, you know, very confident in their position, and the whole group knows that their position, if some newcomer doesn't quite know the rules and, you know, is out of line, kind of disrespects somebody who doesn't know the rules, disrespects the head honcho or the top dog, they don't necessarily need to react violently or to reinstate, because their, let's say, rule is firm. It's not seen as a threat. Again, a ruler who's right. maybe not so secure, they have to respond with the full force to even any minor threat to their leadership.
Yeah, no, what you say is exactly right. And of course, it follows from the culture of honor. If you're 6'6" and you weigh 250 pounds of solid muscle, nobody thinks that you're soft. And so if I come up to you and push you away and say, hey, man, this is my bar seat, and you look down at me and you sort of smile and say, sure, you can have it, nobody in the bar is going to go, oh, that guy's really weak and soft. I can take him. You haven't lost anything under that circumstance because you're so obviously capable. It's people who are not so obviously capable who have to demonstrate that they're tough and that they aren't to be trifled with. And so you raise a very good point that when it's inherently obvious to the most casual observer that the person is not someone to be trifled with, then they don't have to worry about protecting their honor because it's already covered, right? The problem is solved. And of course, if they have immense confidence in themselves, even if they don't look like much, you can imagine like Bruce Lee, right? You give him a shove and say, get out of my way. He could look at you and go, well, I just can't be bothered because it's not really a threat to him. And he doesn't really care what the people right around him think if they don't know him. So I would agree with you. I would say that these rules apply to all of us, but of course, under different degrees, depending on the kind of signals that we give off to others and the things that we're concerned about with regard to ourselves.
Fair enough. So what did we evolve for? Like, if most of our evolution, we were living in hunter-gatherer societies, mm-hmm. and that's generally the hardware and the software that's installed in the system. The software is very adaptive, which is brilliant because we can, you know, there's not, as my understanding is, there's not that much of a software change or between what we were working with in hunter-gatherer societies than what we are working now in very, very complex modern societies with, you know, with governments and the internet and social media and all that. So what was it designed for? What was life like for the hunter-gatherer living in a tribe as far as, you know, their social life, as far as their threats, you know, the type of violence they had to deal with? What are we evolved for in that aspect?
So we evolved to fill what we call a social cognitive niche, which is we're very social beings. We evolved to form tight coalitions with others who are our friends, who are members of our own group. But we also evolved to be very tribal, to not show the same level of care and concern for people or members of other groups. And we're also very cognitive. If you look at our physical capabilities, we have these soft little hands. We're not, you know, a lion can easily kill us. A chimpanzee or a gorilla is so strong, it could rip your arms right off your body. They're geared for strength and we're geared for precision. So we don't have anywhere near the bodily strength that other animals, even other animals our size have, because we went down a different path. But that path we went down made us incredibly effective killers because our mind is so strong and because we're so effective when we connect our minds to each other. And so we're cultural animals. We adopt whatever culture we're in. And that was the point you were making earlier, whether we're hunter-gatherers or living in a modern city state with the internet and social media and all that, we very easily learn the rules of the society we live in, no matter what those rules are. But what that means is that we're also very aware of, well, what are the opportunities and costs of any behavior that I engage in? And because the world that those of us who are lucky enough to live in Western democracies live in is very safe and we have very stable governments, we're allowed to, you know, we move away from doing violent things because they're just going to get you in trouble. You know, if you get in a bar fight and beat the guy up and everybody's impressed, you still end up in prison, right? So it doesn't do you any good. And so in our modern world, our violence is far less likely to emerge because in general, it'll just get us in trouble. Now, in contrast to that, in our hunter-gatherer world, you had to get by on with your wits, just like we do now. But you also had to supplement getting by with your wits with violence on occasion because there is no law enforcement whatsoever. And so if you do come into my hut and we do get arguing about something really important, one of us can kill the other. And under the right circumstances, there'll be no consequences for that. And so I can't just say, well, Ron will assuredly leave. The cops will be here in a minute. Nobody's coming, right? And so you have to find a way to deal with yourself. And so you, first and foremost, you try to use this big organ here, which is what made us so powerful. But if that's not working, we tended to rely on a clan network, a bunch of male kin who are our sort of armed forces, so to speak. And if intimidation didn't work in the end, sometimes then deadly violence ensued. And the levels of deadly violence, even the most peaceful hunter-gatherer societies are way higher than they are in modern societies in Europe, North America, Middle East, wherever you go.
I think in your book you put an analogy that living in a hunter-gatherer society, it was like living in an episode of The Sopranos, that the murder rates were through the roof.
Murder rates are through the roof. And every day, you don't know if it might happen to you. It's going to take, you got to stay friends with the right people. You have to manage the jealousies and animosities of the other people. You've got to navigate this very complicated world that's like one of those episodes where if you do things wrong, you know, the Sopranos can't go to the cops because they're engaged in illegal activities, right? They have to manage their own security. And we had to manage our own security when we were hunter-gatherers. And we relied on networks of kin, but in the end, they can't be counted on if you've done the wrong thing. So you have to maintain coalitions, you have to maintain friendships, you have to live in this kind of dicey world where your safety and security depends on your intelligence and your good social skills.
So, hence the big brains. So in your book, exactly. in your book, the argument is that we've developed such large brains and such cognitive abilities in order to be able to keep track of all these interpersonal relationships. And I need to calculate all the time, not just what I'm doing, but how you're perceiving what I'm doing. And, you know, when we go for a hunt next time, are you going to be by my side if I'm in trouble? I mean, as a soldier, you can understand it 100% because as soldiers, there's this bond. Like you understand that if you're wounded behind enemy lines, you know that your brothers are going to do everything in their capacity and risk their own life and limb in order to save you and pull you back. That's kind of without that, we just couldn't function. If I thought that, okay, if I'm going to risk myself and I'm going to go out and lay cover fire or whatnot, or I expect you to lay cover fire and I'm going to charge, I need to count on you. If you don't do your job, I'm going to be dead. There's no question about that. Yep. And
so you used an interesting word. You said your brothers, and you said that even though you know that they're literally not physically your brothers, but we actually evolved that when we're in combat and we're one team against our, you know, group against another group, that we feel like family, we feel like brothers. And I work with the Australian Special Forces, and they don't feel closer to anybody than they feel to the members of their unit who they were in combat with, who looked out for each other, because they know exactly that. They know everybody has each other's back to 100%. And never else in life does that feeling emerge. And in fact, when these guys are no longer in combat and they come home and then one of them's a little late and they're planning to get a beer and they're like, I'll screw them. We're going to go without them. Well, you just would never do that if, you know, you were if there you are in Afghanistan or wherever the conflict was and you're under heavy combat. It doesn't matter how inconvenient that person's behavior is. Everybody still bands together. And so we evolved to do that because it was so mission critical when our groups came into conflict with each other. And they felt like brothers. Suddenly that family bond is extended to your whole group of your unit or whatever the case might be. And so that analogy comes really easily to us.
Absolutely. And I found with the people that I was serving with, sometimes, you know, most of them I loved, some of them were pricks, but it didn't matter. Like I could have,
right.
I found it quite interesting because some of my best friends in the army, the people who, you know, I trained with and, you know, you get so intimate with these people. I mean, you go through so much of your life and you're under combat and your life is under threat if you're deployed. And, you know, you go through such also a change with them. But sometimes, you know, it's funny, you really enjoy spending time with them in the army and you're there. And then it's like, no, like it wouldn't be your first choice to have a beer with. Like, you know, socially, you might say, okay, look, we're different. We don't really have that much connection. But when you're there in the thick of it, there's nobody closer to you. And that's very different from how we choose our friendships outside of it. Generally, you know, in civilian life, the way I choose my friends are people who I have things in common with, people who I enjoy discussing things with. And in the army, it's really about loyalty. It's about people who I know are going to have my back.
And you feel incredibly close to them. You know, the guys talk about how they feel closer to their buddies who they've been in combat with than they feel to their wives in some ways. Despite the fact that, as you point out, they may be way fonder of their wives than they are of these guys, but that there's a bond that gets formed that's evolutionarily very, very old, and that there's no other circumstance quite like it.
I find it quite interesting because there's also a connection to, like, Israeli society is a very, very different society from other places that I've experienced in two aspects. On the one hand, the Jews that came to Israel, and even the Jews that have been living in Israel in centuries, they all had a similar experience. Doesn't matter where they were in the world, whether they were in Europe, whether they were in the Middle East, whether it was Jews that were living in Yemen or Morocco or Poland or in Jerusalem for centuries, they were all persecuted on accounts of their being Jewish. And as refugees, they understood, and even as a persecuted nation living in the diaspora, the only way for survival was to stick together and look out for one another, regardless of whether you liked the other person or not. Just them belonging to the same group, you knew that you had a responsibility to look after them, and you also knew that you'd be welcome and you'd be looked after as well. And that's kind of something that came into that's unique in Israeli society, that it's a nation that's made out of there are a lot of countries that were made by that, you know, were developed by largely immigration population, but Israel is a nation that was that all of the population was persecuted in diaspora and got together. And the other aspect is that military service is compulsory, so that's very much part of Israeli society, that the, you know, everybody serves, the men and the women, and then that comes into us, that kind of the hierarchies later that go into the corporate world. It's one of the big questions. Okay, where did you serve? What did you do? It's part of our, so it makes it very unique, the things that we discussed, that they're kind of exist in the military aspect and are different in civilian. There's still aspects, a lot of those aspects in civilian life in Israel.
Yeah, and the underlying point there is that the, you know, people who are in the majority, who feel like they kind of run the show, they don't necessarily feel a tight bond to each other because there's so many different agendas and nobody's looking at them as a member of Group X. So if you live in the United States, traditionally you didn't feel, if you're white, you didn't feel that being white was important to you, because most people were white, and so it just was irrelevant. It was just background. But when you're a minority anywhere on earth, and you feel people are looking at you as that minority, then it becomes more important to you, and particularly if you're a persecuted minority. And so your point about, you know, Jews is a really good one, that they've been a persecuted minority since the diaspora began, and as a consequence, they feel this tight bond to each other because they need to, right? It's the only successful strategy. Again, it's one that we've evolved, that there's tribalism is unfortunately part and parcel of human nature, because our most important competitors were not the other animals. Once we got as smart as we did, they're kind of irrelevant to us. They're more dinner than they are competition. The only real competition is other groups of humans who can form these effective fighting units that we can form. And so you see this kind of psychology. And as a consequence, as you point out, Israel ends up being a rather unique society where people feel more bonded to each other as a consequence. But you know, it's also the case that when the external threat disappears, bickering always starts within the camp, right? And so Israelis bicker like crazy, because so long when they're not being attacked, then they'll come together. But when they're not being attacked, when everything's peaceful, then that's human nature too, to constantly have disagreements and arguments about what's the best way forward.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you see it everywhere. In Israel, every time, unfortunately, we have quite a few wars and attacks, and in between, we bicker like crazy. But when there's a real threat, everybody gets together. Yeah. I mean, we saw it better than in the United States in 9/11. That brought the country yep. together, like nothing else. They understood that, okay, we're as a society are under threat, and then we're all part of the same group.
Yep, absolutely.
And then yeah, it's amazing what how kind of we can shift from going forward, from being yeah. competition with one another within the group, of understanding, wait a second, our group is under threat, we better stop this competition, we better get together, and we better you know, in order to survive.
Yeah, it's an evolved part of our human nature to set aside our differences when there's an external threat, because external threats are existential threats. If that group beats our group, they'll typically kill all the males. And so you just said, well, you know, Ron, you and I can't always agree, but today we're going to agree because we got to deal with them. And then tomorrow we can go back to disagreeing if necessary when the threat is gone. And that's just human nature.
I want to kind of circle back to, mm-hmm. we were talking about the various responses, the fight, flight, posture, submit to violence. There's another one in there, which is the freeze response. We see a lot of times when mm-hmm. people are subject to threat, they just kind of stop and they freeze. Obviously, this has got to have a evolutionary benefit. We can look at, you know, when you don't move the... I remember, what was it? It was Jurassic Park or something like that. They decided that if you don't move, then the T-Rex can't see you because it's...
That was made up, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we don't know what they could see about movement. But what we do know is that all visual systems are way better detecting movement than they are detecting still shapes. And so it's a super common thing that if you're prey and there's a predator stalking you, the first thing you're going to do is hold really still, because it's actually can be hard to pick you out. And so we've got this freezing moment, which is really evolutionarily old. If I hold really still, I may not be detected. It's also a case that sometimes you hold really still because you're literally stuck between fight and flight, and you can't do both. You know, one's going toward and one's going away, and the indecision equals hold still. So that's very common as well. But it is a very old animal system to just freeze in hopes that the visual detection properties that are engaged in by the predator won't see you now that you're not moving.
I've always seen it as in some aspect, maybe a bit of like a, not a bug in the system, but kind of, like you said, it's kind of like the push and the pull between, if I have a dog chasing, a dog now came out of a yard and is growling at me. I don't quite know. I need more cues. I need more understanding of what's the right thing to do, because sometimes, the right thing is to pick up a rock, which is amazing because dogs have instincts that the moment you bend down, the dogs run away. It's not a taught behavior. It's not a dog. Every dog does that. You don't need to throw rocks at dogs to condition them to run away. The moment you bend down as if to pick up a rock, dogs will scatter. So maybe that's the right response. Maybe the right response is, you know, standing up tall with good posture and start walking towards the dog. Or sometimes the right response is to turn around and try to climb a tree or run as fast as you can, or whatever you do. And it's not immediately obvious. And I guess the argument I'm putting forward is, let's say you've never been in that situation before, I think you're going to be more likely to freeze because you don't have the context, you don't have the mental pathway to know what the appropriate response that's going to help you survive is going to be. But if you've been in situations where you've been threatened by dogs many times, the likelihood of you freezing is very, very low. And I kind of draw that analogy into my self-defense teaching. It's one of the first things you learn if you come to one of my Krav Maga classes is we'll teach you what to do if somebody puts their hands on your throat and tries to, you know, squeeze your windpipe shut with both hands. It seems to be somewhat of a natural response. When humans attack other humans, generally we go for the throat and we squeeze. It's arguably the easiest way to kill somebody with your bare hands. It's much more guaranteed. If you can shut off your air supply, their air supply, rather than start, you know, bashing them on the head, that kind of seems to get the job right. Now, that's a very stressful situation. That first of all, you've been assaulted. The understanding is maybe you didn't see it coming, because if somebody was able to put their hands on your throat, it came as a surprise. If you would have seen it coming, you would have probably done something, stepped away, swiped the hands out, even instinctively to try to prevent it. And then all of a sudden you can't breathe. It's very... And your body knows straight away. In training, the first time when I get, you know, beginner students, the first time somebody has their hands on their throat, even if they're not choking, you see their eyes just widen up. Like the body knows, they've never been in a situation, but the body knows exactly what's going on. You see like their face just says, oh shit. And this is a controlled environment. They knew that this was going to happen. The partner isn't, you know, squeezing, but the body doesn't understand that. And kind of my argument towards that is, if you've trained on this several times and you've been in a situation, you've built the mental pathways. When this happens, your body goes, I recognize this. I know exactly what to do. But if you've never trained on this and something like that, you've never been in a situation before, then your body goes, shit, I don't know what to do. And then you just kind of freeze because you don't have, it's kind of like the brain is buffering. It doesn't really know what's expected.
Yeah. And so the problem is that freezing is the exact wrong thing to do when somebody's grabbing your windpipe and really means to squeeze it, because then you're just a victim, right? Whereas, and in a wide variety of other circumstances, freezing is the right thing to do. So if this dog is growling coming toward me and I don't know its intentions and I stop and freeze, then the dog sees I'm not running away and it's taller than I am, maybe I'll let him go. If it's a predator and I freeze, maybe it didn't see me yet because my movement didn't attract his attention. If it's you in a bar telling me that you want to fight and I stop and freeze, you're like, well, he's not backing off. Maybe I shouldn't be getting in this conflict. So I suspect that 9 times out of 10, freezing doesn't necessarily have a cost, and it may even have a benefit. The problem is that then you're going to do it the 10th time when it's nothing but cost. And that is, you know, somebody's got you by the windpipe and you want to do anything but freeze. You have to make some decision. Whatever decision you make, you want to make it quickly and go with it, right? And so all of these default tendencies that we typically engage in on average serve us well, but they can be super costly under the wrong circumstances.
Tell me if this makes sense. Now, when we're talking about it, it's actually I think freezing more commonly happens in response to the threat of violence and not violence itself. When we were talking about the dog, or, you know, even if you know, you walk by, you see a snake on the floor, which is it's a good thing to freeze there. Or if you're in savannah and in Africa and you see a lion, you see it. It's not attacking you yet. It's right. collecting information on you and trying to decide what the right course of action for the lion is. And you're sitting there and you might, you know, you're just confronted with this problem. You don't have all the information yet. So by freezing, like if I were to start running, I would prompt a natural reaction from the dog, right? Dogs, when you start running, mm-hmm. the dogs just start chasing. Yeah. It's a natural instinct. But by me freezing, it goes, wait a second, let's collect some more information about the situation and determine what's the right thing to do. On the contrary, if the dog has already got a hold of your foot and is starting to shake, I don't think you freeze there. I don't think I can't see anybody freezing there. So maybe I restate my argument, my question, that freezing is not a response to the assault in itself, but it's a response to the threat of the assault.
Yeah, it's almost never, because even an animal that knows it will lose, if it's attacked, you know, a mouse will try to fight the cat. It just doesn't have much at its disposal that it can do because its mouth is so tiny. But and so once you're under attack, it is, you know, especially biting or hitting, people tend to cover up or defend or run or fight back. But it is the case that those are early evolved systems. The better training you have, not only the more effectively you're going to fight back, but you're also going to be way better at assessing the threat. Because the problem is that if I don't know how to fight and you swap me once, I don't know if what you did was scary and could really do me harm, or was just flailing and is really, I should laugh you off. But the more I know, the more I can assess those threats. And of course, it's also the case that the more experience you have in any circumstance, the more that you can engage in deliberation and decision-making rather than immediate choice, because you go, oh, I've been here before. Bullets are flying, it's dangerous, but I've got time to figure out what the best plan of attack is versus I've never had anyone shoot at me, bullets are flying, I'm going to cry and run away kind of situation.
100%, actually. When you say that, actually, the first time I was in combat, the first time I was actively shot at, your instinct kind of takes in, the training does kind of come in, of taking cover, of I found that actually very clear. But then when it came time to shoot back, the first time I was under fire, I pulled up my back then it was M4s, nowadays we use Tavors, but that was an M4 rifle, and I just started shooting, and I didn't go in between the sights. I wasn't shooting. I just, you know, pointed the gun in the general direction and started shooting it. And it was interesting, because you don't do that as a soldier. Like, all your training consists of going in between the sights and shooting. At least back then, things have changed a little bit. But I'd never shot out of my sights. But the first time I was under fire, my natural reaction was just, you know, just start shooting. And I didn't even think of trying to take aim at the enemy. And then, you know, second time, third time around, now you have a little bit more experience in the field and you go, okay, I've been here before. Now let's, it's more of action as opposed to just pure reaction. I know that's not, I can't remember what movie it was. It's a well-known phenomenon that soldiers under fire, especially inexperienced soldiers, just, maybe you're familiar with it, but I remember there were studies done that, you know, they just generally tend to shoot up in the air or shoot in the general direction. They don't actually aim to shoot
Yeah, because it's all just action. It's not, I mean, it's all mindless. You can't drop into what you're meant to be doing because it's too scary and it's too overwhelming. You know, our attentional focus narrows when we get highly aroused, and that narrow attentional focus fails to allow us to do, you know, our proper response isn't automated yet. And so you have to have a controlled response, and it's not accessible to you because you're too much anxiety, too much adrenaline, and all that sort of thing. But all the guys that I work with in the special forces here talk about what it's like the first time, second time, third time. And then it becomes, oh, I've been here before. I know what to do. And it's not even that scary because, you know, I got through it every other time. So what seems like wildly life-threatening doesn't even seem as wildly life-threatening once you've been there several times.
That's what I've kind of tried to take into my Krav Maga training. Because the question is, okay, how can you teach people who haven't grown up in violence and haven't, you know, are not conditioned to violence to be able to defend themselves, to carry out these skills in a highly challenging and adrenaline-filled situation that's very scary? And the answer I've kind of found with that is try as accurately as possible in a safe manner to recreate the situations,
yeah,
or to create the situations that they're going to be facing. Because then if they're there, they're going to go, okay, this is familiar. It has to be done gradually, because if I was to create the actual situation on the first class, I wouldn't have very many students. You kind of got to build kind of like a cognitive behavioral training in the realm of, I remember listening to psychology speak about teaching people to deal with agoraphobia, people who are afraid to go outside, of how you gradually condition people to get over their fears. And it's not, you're not training people to not be afraid, because the fear is always, always there. You're actually training people to recognize themselves as being brave and being up for the challenge of being able to, it would be very bad, by the way, if soldiers went around going, well, I've been shot at many times. I've survived, so I'm no longer afraid of bullets. That wouldn't be a very good survival strategy. The better survival strategy is, I've been shot at many times. I know what the consequences are. You know, any one of these bullets whizzing by can kill me, but yet I've been here before. I'm capable of dealing with this particular situation.
Yeah. And so that's why it requires, you know, if you think back to our ancient environment, there's a saber-tooth running at me. I have to decide, can I club it hard enough to win, or do I need to run for that tree? And there's only two choices, try to smash it or try to run away. But now imagine you're under fire or you're in a bar and there's a fight developing or whatever. There's lots and lots of choices. And so what our mind is not good at is going, okay, pause. I know there's lots going on, but let me think through my options and decide what to do. And we get better and better at doing that deliberation phase, even under high stress, if the situation that we're in becomes more and more familiar to us, because we can access the answer more quickly. We're a little bit less stressed because the situation is more familiar. And so in an ancient world, we would never need to really deliberate when we're under stress, because there's only two choices. But now in this sort of more modern, complex world of ours, where there might be many, many choices about how to best deal with the threat, we actually need that sort of mental space to engage in deliberation. And that comes with an enormous amount of practice, and it comes with the situation seeming more familiar and you slowly getting used to it, so you can sort of dampen your fear enough to focus on what are the key things that I need to, what are the information I need to pick up, and then the decisions I need to make in response to that.
That makes a lot of sense. So if you're trying to kind of figure out on the spot when your heart is racing, the chances of you making a good decision are not very high. But if you've already thought, there are two ways to deal with it. Either you can be in the situation enough times that you know what to do, and that's not something that, you know, that's not something that's feasible or recommended of, in order to, if I'm trying to teach, you know, the average Joe to be safe, or you know, the average Jill to be able to protect yourself from sexual assault or from violence, my recommendation wouldn't be go out and actively put yourself in enough violent situations so that you have experience to deal with that. But the advice would be, at least think it through. And that like, put yourself mentally in these situations. In training, we do that physically, which is helpful. But if you don't have access to training, if you can't do that, then at least think, what if I was in a situation, somebody was following me, I noticed somebody was following me through a park, okay? What would I do? in that situation? Would I, would I turn around and confront them? Would I start running? Would I change my body language? And then what happens if they did approach me? What happens if they put, a hand on me? How would I respond? And the moment we start putting ourselves in these situations, then if it ever happened, we've already created the mental pathways. We already kind of envisioned that. And then the answer to that is, it's kind of like I've already studied for the test. So then when I get asked the question, I can retrieve it quicker. But if I've never studied for the test, I've never been there, and I get asked that question, it's like, how do I even start? How do I expect myself to even be able to answer that? And I guess the answer to that is, it's going to be instinctual. It's going to be based on my reactions, which my natural reactions, which may be suitable for the situation, or it might not, because reality is complex. But having thought it through beforehand gives me more agency and more options.
And of course, it helps a lot to not only think it through, but to have practiced the response that you intend to give. So if I think, oh, what if that guy texts me in the park? I'll karate chop them, but I don't know how to do that. What good is it going to do me, right? But if I've actually practiced my response and I've thought through the situation, then I'm in the best possible scenario.
There's actually another aspect to it. It's because, look, there's a problem in the martial arts world. A lot of what there's kind of a difference between sport, combat, competitive fighting, and martial arts, where they're not competitive, let's say. And people just tend to label both self-defense. But the truth is, neither of them are exactly that. Both of them are actually designed. I mean, when we think about karate, we're training, or we're thinking about kung fu, it's two guys, going at it with the karate moves, or, a karate going against the kung fu guy, or like in early UFC things. It's like, whose kung fu is better? I say, if I take Joe, who weighs 70 kilos, and I take Jack, who also weighs 72 kilos, and they've both been training for 10 years, Joe's been training in boxing, Jack's been training in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, let's say, and then I ask who would win that fight. And that's generally what we think about when we go to learn martial arts or we watch competitive sports. And then we get an answer suitable for that. But the truth is that self-defense is very rarely two evenly matched individuals that are willingly there with an intention of participating in competition. And I go about, people say that, self-defense has no rules. I can kick to the balls. I can do, that's part of it. But I don't think that's the key thing that differentiates martial arts and competitive sport from self-defense. I think that the purpose is really competitive sports is two blokes or women. Nowadays, there's beautiful, beautiful UFC women's divisions. But generally, that's kind of the answer that these things were built to answer. Where self-defense, it's really about how does a woman defend herself against a much larger male who's looking to and then it gets much more complex. It's not necessarily they jump out of the bush to grab you. Like we have reactions that are actually quite good to deal with that. That's a natural reaction. But what do you do when it's somebody that you know? Like, what do you do when it's somebody from your workplace who's maybe a bit drunk and they're starting, they're starting to be handsy, and from there it can develop into very nasty places. The answer to that is not as simple, and it's not necessarily the karate chop. I guess to finish that kind of tangent or that rant, even the karate chop in the martial art world, a lot of times it's because I can't really simulate the environment that I want. Like in the best scenario, if I was training my students, if you came to me for class, I'd get, I'd get student A, I'd give him a real knife, and I'd tell him, I want you to try to kill Bill, as hard as you can. And I'd say, Bill, now all the techniques that we were using, use that to survive. And then we get an answer, has your training worked or not? The problem is you don't get many students like that. You get lawsuits that way. So I need to give the training partner a rubber knife, and also on the other hand, I can't get you with the bare knuckles, to punch your training partner as hard as you can in the face, because again, you guys aren't going to come for Monday's class afterwards. So I got to, at the very least, I got to give you gloves. But what happens is this cooperative training. So I walk around with the assumption that, my karate chop is going to knock down, you know, any assailant. And then I might be in for a rude surprise, because in all my training, we train by the rule. We know I throw my karate chop,
right,
and then you go down, because that's what the teacher told us to do. And we know that, and we've been told that karate chops, you know, knock people down. So that's the expectation. And then if I was, I mean, the UFC, the early competitions was a very rude awakening, because a lot of people came in with a certain expectation of their skills. And then the first time they had to do it against a non-cooperative opponent, it just didn't work. But there is benefit. You talk about in your book, there is benefit to self-delusion, right? Just walking around thinking that my karate chop is good, that'll already get me pretty far.
Yeah. So if I start throwing my weight around with you, even if you're inept, if you believe you're not inept, you'll look pretty confidently at me and tell me to piss off. And I'll say, huh, I feel like I could take this guy, but he sure looks like he's got a lot of confidence. Maybe I ought to let it go. And so, again, that always holds with conspecifics, members of the same species, who basically don't want to fight. They basically just want to establish who the winner be. With predator and prey, it doesn't work that way, because, you know, you, the gazelle, and me, the cheetah, I'm not going to go, well, you know, if you're the one I've already chosen, I'm going to keep chasing you till I catch you or I don't. And both of us are highly motivated. You know, one of us is going to succeed and one of us is going to fail. But if we're both humans or both gazelles or whatever, we'd really rather not fight. We'd really rather just wash itself. But again, the rules change when it's in a group as well. And so we can end up in the same horrible situation they are when two groups come into conflict with each other, because then it can have that predator-prey quality to it.
So what is it about group violence that's so vicious? Like, you know, you see when two people are going at it, it can be completely different when it's a mob, lynching, or when it's a group of people attacking another individual. It turns out often much, much more bloody and deadly. Why are we so vicious in groups?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's more than one answer, of course, but I would say that the primary answer is that morality, which we talked about much earlier in this discussion, it did not evolve in order to be used between groups. Morality is an intra-group device. And so we all come together and we agree on the same set of rules that apply to us, but hunter-gatherers never applied those rules to them. And so you don't really count. The moral forces don't apply to you. And so if two humans just get into a brawl, they usually don't make it completely deadly, because they feel, all right, I've won. I made my point. You can crawl off now and game over. But when it's a group, and then therefore what you're usually attacking is a person who's not a member of that group, you end up in the circumstance where they don't feel fully human to you, and you can do whatever you want to them. And hunter-gatherers, when they come into conflict, there's no quarter given or expected. You know, you don't take prisoners, because you will torture them to death once you bring them home. Everybody fights to the death. And if you're the bad luck that you get knocked unconscious and get brought home, well, you can fully expect to be tortured to death when you get there, assuming you're male. If you're female, you'd be captured and just incorporated into the group, which may not be your preference, but it's a whole lot better than being tortured to death.
I was just reading a book, Empire of the Summer Moon, which talks about...
It's a great example of that, right?
But yeah, it's like the viciousness is, on the one hand, it's absolutely brutal. Like, you know, you live, these are societies that are not that long ago. They're not like the mechanisms are, you know, it's not that far removed from where we are today. And it seems, on the one hand, so barbaric, but if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, it makes perfect sense, because the cost of like the intimidation factor of that, if you lose against us, you're going to be tortured, you know, your wives are going to be taken, like the cost is so high. Why, like, unless you're absolutely certain that you're going to win, like you run like hell. And that's a very, it's terrorism. It really is a form of terrorism in terms of instilling terror in the hearts of the people. You've actually I'd assume in many cases you win without fighting over there, because
yes and no. So, I mean, that's a wonderful book, and it gives a really good, clear example, very well documented, of the level of violence you get between these societies. But if you look at it, there's a more academic book, for example, Keeley has this book called War Before Civilization. And if you look at what hunter-gatherer conflicts are actually like, they're not pitched battles like we're used to in a modern world, where large numbers go against large numbers. That'll occasionally happen, but it's much more skirmishes. And it's much more likely that, you know, my group and I are out wandering, and then you have the bad luck that we catch you, you're up a tree, picking coconuts. And bad luck you, there's a bunch of us and only you, and we just perforate you like a pincushion with our bows and arrows, and we move on. And the reason for that is now my group is, relatively speaking, a little bit stronger compared to your group, because we just took out one warrior on your side. And so that kind of very deadly low-level skirmishes are super common and have existed throughout hunter-gatherer societies forever. And the Empire of the Summer Moon is a really nice documented example of just how brutal it is when it happens. But we see that repeatedly over and over everywhere. And it makes good sense. It's the wars don't happen, but these constant low-level raids where when an opportunity presents itself, we enact deadly vengeance or we take deadly violence on each other is unfortunately all too common.
From an evolutionary perspective, it makes perfect sense, because the cost of an all-out war is immeasurable. It's crazy, especially in the modern period. But even then, the cost of, you know, yep, the entire, you know, all the men from one tribe going against all the men from another tribe, the evolutionary cost of that is insane. Why would you ever want to do something like that? The skirmishes goes, I can actually move you on. If I carry out skirmishes and the cost of those skirmishes are too much for you, also from a psychological perspective, you're like, screw this, I'm going to move out, you know, further out into the desert. I don't want to keep on getting. So it's the skirmishes are a very effective way of taking minimal damage to you by taking such a great psychological toll on the opposition to get them to move, you know, another 100 kilometers down the road and getting access to the resources.
Yep. And so, unfortunately, it's all too common. I mean, it's an unfortunate part of human nature that we have this inherent tendency to look at members of other groups as not necessarily an enemy, but it's highly likely to be a threat, and that we are very willing to exploit and take advantage of members of other groups when the opportunities present itself. And we're way, way more cooperative with each other within our own group than chimpanzees are. They're way more violent with their group members, but we're just as violent as chimpanzees are when we look at between group conflict. So humans have become much kinder and more cooperative, but only within their own groups, not across the whole spectrum of humanity.
In this modern age, what is our group like? It's such a complex the answer was, you know, a couple of hundred years ago it was pretty obvious, or even a couple of, you know, thousands of years ago, what a group was. It was, you know, it was your tribe, it was your extended family and so on, and maybe a few families that bonded together. How do you even start to make sense of it nowadays, where, you know, a group could be, you know, just a bunch of people on Facebook in different places around the world, or, you know, it could be like a group. There can be so many different kinds of groups. How does that even work?
Yeah, so the boundaries are super flexible, and you can become my group member today when you and I are on Facebook making fun of somebody else, and then you could become not my group another day when another coalition that I've come together with is attacking you. And so I would say that what makes you feel that groupiness, that bond, is very slippery in a modern multi-ethnic society with lots of different agendas going on all the time. And it was very concrete back in the day, but it's still the case that there's some very reliable ways to predict that you're going to feel groupy with somebody. And when your country is attacked by another country, or if there's a civil war within your country and one group is attacking another, quickly people pick sides. They just can't help themselves. And they're going to all feel tight bond to everybody who's in their group, and they're going to feel animosity toward the other group. And it could be another group that they never even cared about before, but suddenly now that other group is attacking them or is a threat to them in some kind of way, and they're going to care a great deal, and they dehumanize them. They do what they can to, you know, to exterminate them, so to speak, get rid of the problem.
That does seem like, you know, the worst catastrophes that happened, you know, that humans did upon humans. The first stage seems, it's not even the first, the compulsory stage seems to be to dehumanize the other group. We saw that in the Holocaust. We saw that through the class system in communist China and communist Russia. It was really about like the worst catastrophes in order to attack someone. And we even see it like now with intergroup, some cultures wouldn't even imagine robbing or raping somebody from their group. Like they see it as completely, immoral, wrong. But then when it extends to another group, they go, well, they're not human. They don't perceive it. That's
yeah. And Peter Singer talks about this, these moral circles. And it used to be that our moral circles were really just around our family and close coalition kin. And that was how the whole world lived. And then they get broader and broader. And soon your moral circle encompasses everyone who lives in your country. And then it encompasses maybe, hopefully, everybody in the whole world. And then maybe it encompasses non-human animals. You know, your moral circle can grow and grow as you start to think about, well, make conscious moral decisions about what do I think is worth protecting and what do I think has rights and things like that. But it is the case that what we've evolved is for that moral circle to be very narrow.
Mm. Maybe we go a little bit more focused now. So why, traditionally, why do people fight? What are the sources of, what are the mechanisms that push us to violence? What are the benefits to be gained?
Yeah, so the thing is that fighting is an interesting case. It's a little bit like anger. And so if you ask, why would anger ever evolve? Because it gets me to do things that are contrary to my own self-interest. So you make me angry in some way, and I come up and slug you. Well, that just can't be a good thing. You're way bigger and stronger than I am. And so why would I ever want to evolve an emotion that would get me to act in such an irrational way that would cause me such trouble down the road? And the answer is, that anger, if you know that I get angry, and if you know that when I get angry, I'm going to even act in something that's not even my best interest, that I'll literally punch you, despite the fact that you'll end up beating me up, you think, well, I don't want to make Bill angry because I don't want him to punch me. He's going to do it even though he's going to lose, and I don't want to go through that. And so it's these emotions actually benefit me because now it means that you're far less likely to cross me, to do the wrong thing, because this anger, this commitment device that gets me to act in a way that's not in the moment of my self-interest, in the longer term is in my self-interest. And violence works the exact same way. If I have a credible threat of violence toward you, well, then you're going to respect my property, you're going to respect my friends, you're going to respect my family because I'm a credible threat of violence. But to be a credible threat of violence, I have to engage in violence sometimes. And so if you can imagine two organisms, two humans in back in the day, one who would never engage in violence and one who would, you could quickly see the one who's willing to engage in violence is going to outcompete the one who won't. It's going to gain all sorts of advantages. And what that means is that we as a species evolved to be very willing to engage in violence when the circumstances were rewarding of it, but not necessarily when the circumstances weren't. And that's why our societies are so flexible. Why the same Vikings who were killing everybody 1,000 years ago aren't killing anybody anymore. Because the human psyche is so flexible, it can quickly understand, well, this is when violence is going to be necessary and or useful for me, and this is when it's not. But in the ancestral world, there was no all-powerful government. There were no police. There were no laws, so to speak. They were universally enforceable. And so violence was a really easy way to solve problems. And of course, it was typically coalitional violence. You know, it's very risky for me to attack you. But if I get my six friends, there's almost no risk at all. We can take care of you easily. And that's what humans tended to do.
So often it's separated. The types of violence are separated to social violence and predatory violence, and the social violence can be, let's say, to either enforce group norms or cultures. If somebody gets out of line, then, or if somebody is behaving in ways that are detrimental to the group members, then they can bash them to put them in place, or they can use the at the very least the threat of violence on the one hand. So that we see a lot, and often that type of violence can be quite brutal.
Yeah, so it is the case that hunter-gatherers as well will enforce group rules with sometimes even deadly violence, depending on how bad is the norm is that you've broken. And it makes perfect sense because human behavior has to be controlled. You know, the group has to have a basic set of rules that it tends to follow. And that's kind of what group morality is. It's us inventing our set of rules. Like every society on earth has the golden rule: do unto others as you want them to do unto you. That's universal. Other ones, there's some variability. But the point is that those sets of rules guide a society and enable people to know what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And the easiest way to enforce those things is violence. Now, if you look at hunter-gatherers, they don't go straight to violence. They'll typically start making fun of you first, or they'll ignore you first. Now, if you think about it, why do little kids get so bothered when you make fun of them? Why do adults get so bothered if you make fun of us? Why do little kids or adults get so bothered if we're ostracized and ignored? Well, there's no harm in either of those two things, but what there is every single hunter-gatherer society for millennia have used this as a ratcheting up strategy. You're misbehaving, and so we all go, oh, Ron thinks he's the big man, eh? Oh, Ron's the tough guy in a group. We make fun of you. If you don't get it, well, now things are going to get worse. Now maybe we just ostracize you and don't talk to you. If you don't get that, well, now we're going to resort to violence. And so there's nobody left in our ancestral line who wasn't sensitive to being made fun of and wasn't sensitive to rejection, because those are the initial strategies that humans use before they resort to violence when they're trying to engage in intra-group control within their group. All the rules are different between groups, but that's the primary source that we faced within our groups for our risk of being physically harmed, is that it never happened without a little bit of a warning in the form of making fun of or rejection. And that's a huge part of the reason that those things are so painful to us, because we have to learn to find those things painful. We have to evolve to find those things painful so we make sure we don't take the next step and get ourselves killed.
That's it's fascinating, and especially if you know what, I mean, on the one hand, it's instinct. And on the other hand, when you kind of see it happening, you know, societies like prison societies and prison gangs and things like that's certainly what comes to mind in terms of the certain rules and certain norms in order to complete the group. And sometimes the outsider needs to be kind of brought in line so that they need to be taught the group rules. There's the other aspect of it, of social violence, of status-seeking behavior. Sometimes there's to be able to rise up in the group, more in more historical sense, of that my ability to assert my position is to be able to beat up and to be able to exert to a certain level violence on others.
Yeah, so the threat of realistic violence always allows people to rise up in the coalition. So let's say that we're back in the day and there's no law enforcement, we're hunter-gatherers, and my partner doesn't like violence and she doesn't want a violent husband, and I'm a really easygoing guy. I seem perfect to her. But if you come in and threaten me and I can't stand up to that threat, well, then I'm not a very good choice on her part, because I'm going to get pushed around by others and I'm going to drop to the bottom of the status hierarchy. I'll be the last one to get fed. I'll have the worst, the tent that's closest to the edge of, you know, the village where I might get eaten by wolves, whatever. And so status is super important for everybody. Higher status means that partners, coalitional partners, want to join you. And it means the sexual partners want to be aligned with you, because people who are high in status get more of the benefits that the group has to offer than people who are low in status. And one way to gain in status is physical violence, or at least the threat thereof. Because even if we're a group where we're not allowed to fight, if you can make me back down and make me scared and all that, well, then I've lost some status in the world's eyes in my competition with you. Even if by and large, we're a group where we're not allowed to come to blows with each other, it still will be a loss of status if I look like I'm afraid of you, if I look like I have to be deferential to you. And so that threat of physical violence, even if it was rarely used, would nonetheless have been very important.
So what you're saying is that you need to have some ability, some skill in violence to be able to at least communicate that you can exact a cost from anybody who's looking to violence. But unless you're in a warrior culture, then there's not necessarily a benefit to be had of being the best fighter, the best warrior. What we were talking about in the Empire of the Summer Moon, if we understand that most of the societies weren't necessarily warrior societies, that in warrior from the sense of, you know, of pitched battles one against another, The head honcho wasn't necessarily the one who was best at fighting. It was more the younger blokes who went out to carry out the skirmishes, and the guys who held the most sway were the best leaders. Yeah. So you need to have some violence.
The best leaders want to have some warriors at their disposal, but they may or may not be warriors themselves.
Well, warriors are expendable to some extent in these societies. Like, being a warrior isn't the best survival strategy, because you're more likely to die young. But you need, you got to have some political skill. You got to have some political skill.
And if you don't have political skill, if what you are is big, strong, and scary, well, then being a warrior is a pretty good strategy, because your chance of acquiring goods that way from other groups is higher. Your chance of getting respect from your group is higher. It's just a very risky job.
Okay, so those are the social reasons for violence, pretty much. It's either to it's interesting, because, and it draws well, I tell people, often people think in terms of violence and self-defense, they think that they have to beat the other person, right? If somebody's in women's self-defense, often it's taught, okay, you need to do this in order to overpower and to be able to submit your opponent, or to be able to knock them out, or to be able to, but that's rarely the case. Most of the violence is, you just need to exact, it's not a fight to the death. Like when the lion is jumping on the zebra or whatever, the zebra doesn't need to win. It's never going to win. It just needs to be enough of a threat that attacking it is going to go. That's why, one of the reasons why they go for, as I understand, they go for the weaker animals, because they pose less of a risk. A lion needs to eat, you know, hundreds of times throughout the course of their life. And all it takes is one time for one zebra to kick them in the jaw and to break the jaw. A lion with a broken jaw can't hunt, can't eat, and it's going to die. So they need to be very, very careful on the zebras that they choose. And the same thing when I'm teaching women self-defense, I say, you don't need to defeat your opponent. It's like a cat that doesn't want to get picked up, right? The cat is never going to defeat you, right? You're bigger, you're stronger, you outweigh the cat. The cat is never going to, like a small house cat, right, is never going to beat you in a duel to the death, right? And it's funny, because that's kind of how we see violence and self-defense in this context. But the matter of the fact is that the cat just needs to exact enough price. So you say, screw that, I'm not picking up this cat. I'm going to go do something else. And I think that's a very valid thing for self-defense. And it's in line with what you were talking about. You don't need to be able to defeat everybody. You just need to be able to exact enough of a cost from the individual who wants to threaten you, for them to say, you know what, I don't want to attack Ron. This is going to be too risky for me. I'm going to go choose another victim, let's say.
Yes, that's exactly right. You don't want to be the one who looks like the easiest victim. You don't want to look like the weakest zebra. And so when you look at people who get bullied, or when you look at people who are most likely to be chosen to be attacked, they typically look the least athletic, or they look the most timid. They're chosen by perpetrators because that they have signs that there'll be less of a conflict, less of a fight, and that the perpetrator will be less likely to suffer as a consequence. And so it's an unfortunate thing, but what it does tell you is that you want to find ways to portray yourself as not being a victim. And some of those ways are, unfortunately, just your own physical size and your obvious coordination by the way you move your limbs. But of course, part of the reason that people do self-defense training is some of those ways are things that you can learn as well.
It's also a body language, posture, like what we teach. Like we said earlier, that the bad guy doesn't necessarily jump out of the bushes, to attack somebody. First, they'll observe. Just like, it's really kind of like the same process as the lion does, a predator. And that kind of goes into the second. We spoke about the social aspects of violence, which is, you know, to enforce group rules, or in order for status-seeking behavior. But then when we're talking about, let's say, sexual assault or violence between men and women, or what we'd call predatory violence, where the violence in social violence, the violence is kind of the goal. I want to use violence, or I want to put the threat of violence out there, because that's what I want to do. I want to use force. But in predatory violence, the violence is just the tool. It's not really anger. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a reformed criminal, and he was talking about that he used to look at his victims as walking ATMs. Like there was no emotion to it. It was just a source of money. He didn't care about them. They weren't human. They weren't like, he didn't need to hurt them. He didn't need to not hurt them. It was just about efficiently taking the money.
Yeah. And you don't want to look like somebody who can be efficiently have money taken from them, right? Or to be efficiently sexually assaulted. And that's why you talk about confidence as an example. Part of the way I carry myself, if I look like I'm confident, then I also like I can handle myself. And it looks like if you start a conflict with me, I'm not going to just be meek and let you have your way with me. I'm going to respond in an aggressive manner myself. And of course, that's what they're looking to avoid. If violence is just predatory, it's just a tool, then you want to minimize it. You want to choose the easiest victim you can, in the exact same way the lion chooses the zebra who he thinks he can catch.
Mm. We talk about the interview process where they're not just going to, like, we've been talking about a lot about the social cues. There's not necessarily benefit to pounce immediately. First, you know, you're going to observe them. And then maybe we call this interview in a sexual assault situation or robbery. There's not, it pretty much follows the same pattern. Mm-hmm. I'm going to choose my victim by seeing them and watching them move a little bit and behave. And I'm going to try to, do they look assertive? Or are they aware of their surroundings? Do they see me? Do they notice me? Then maybe I'm going to approach them, right? I'm going to get in their personal space. And I want to see what, because there's no cost to me yet. I haven't exposed myself as wanting to attack them. So there's no threat. If the police rocked up now, I haven't done anything illegal yet. And I'm going to see, are they going to make themselves smaller? Like when people are afraid, they have an instinct of making themselves almost try to appear invisible. They minimize their stature. Or is the person going to kind of turn around, confront me and say, back off? Why are you getting so close to me? Who are you? And then that's just it.
So the thing is that in regular interpersonal violence, if you make yourself small, well, I won, right? I know that I get the bar seat now, and I don't have to punch you, and you're not going to punch me back, and you're deferring. And that's what conspecifics want when they're not trying to violent, they're just competing over a resource. And so it's a natural tendency to do when you know you're going to lose, gee, you're bigger than I am. It's that the chair is all yours, Ron, please, my friend, sit down. Let me buy you a beer. The problem is that doesn't work when the person is engaged in predatory violence and doesn't just want some mutually shared resource, when they want something from you. And so now your strategy of being small and being deferential, which would work in a resource competition, won't work at all. And in fact, it goes against you when the person's trying to extract something from you, like sexual assault or like robbing you.
It's like they're opposites, right? If I want to, from status seeking behavior, again, we go back to the two guys fighting in the bar, mm-hmm. the status seeking behavior, it's kind of like it's a balance. There's no status to be get like, okay, if it's a, let's say, you know, a 22-year-old meathead, whatever, and he's in the bar with his friends and he wants to impress everybody about, you know, how tough he is because he's got a chip on his shoulder. If he approaches a small female and starts, you know, bashing her around, that's not going to gain him any social mm-hmm. points. On the contrary, it's going to be seen as pathological behavior, and he's probably going to be mm-hmm. shunned out of any group that's mm-hmm. valuable to be a part of. So, and mm-hmm. and same would go if he chose somebody like half his size. It's really kind of like a balance. And sometimes, actually, we'll see they'll choose somebody, especially in gangs, in let's say gangs that are very violent orientated, they'll actually choose somebody bigger than them somewhat in order to bash them, because there's a lot more, and they'll try to get the fight because there's a lot more status. If I can push down a rung, somebody who's about my size or even bigger, I have much more status to gain. On the contrary, if it's predatory violence and I'm looking for somebody to rob, let's say, I'm going to look for somebody smaller. I'm going to look for somebody that's going to be as little threat to me as possible of retaliation.
Yeah. And so the problem is that when we accidentally engage in behavior that suits one circumstance, but we're in the opposite circumstance, that's what gets us into big trouble, right? And so the natural tendency to respond, which would work like a charm if you were competing over a resource, doesn't work at all if you're it's a predatory circumstance, and vice versa. And so people, especially people who haven't got much experience with violence because they've led a blessedly good life, it's very easy for them to make the mistake and use the wrong strategy in that circumstance and just find themselves into trouble.
I'm going to go and argue with you on this one because, this is a bit dicey, but like we said, generally the evolutionary, from an evolution perspective, the correct response when somebody about your size and stature was to challenge you for social status, the correct response was to posture back and maybe even to engage in fight. And nowadays that's the wrong response. If somebody approaches you in a bar and wants to, you get punished for that by society. If somebody approaches and wants to fight you, the correct response is to submit. But a male who's 20 years old, who's probably going to be the one, is going to be most likely to posture up and engage in behaviors that were beneficial back then, but not behavior now.
Yes. Exactly.
Now let me go to something even more confrontational. Let's start with the easier one, which is robbery. If somebody puts a knife to my throat and says, give me your wallet, and wants it, the best thing is to actually to submit, to say, take my money.
Of course.
Leave me alone. That's the correct evolutionary psychology. Okay, let me go into one that's a bit, I've only started thinking about recently, and it's a very controversial one, and it's not a moral, this is not the moral argument. This is just the genetic or the evolutionary argument, is that sexual assault was historically not necessarily a threat to the to your genes passing on. So let's say if you were to fight against sexual assault back in hunter-gatherer societies, the cost of maybe you getting killed by fighting back was outweighed by the cost of your genes getting passed on. Nowadays, again, to separate the moral argument with, of course, it's definitely valid to fight back as if your life depended on it, and often it should in the situation of sexual assault. But if you look at what our genes were programmed to do, that against predatory violence within our species, whether it was robbery of resources, whether it's sexual assault, maybe submission was the evolutionary strategy. And maybe that's the mismatch. The mismatch is that the way we were kind of developed to do is meet a social threat with violence back and meet a predatory threat with compliance is not the way I see the world today, and not the way most people see the world today. Where if somebody wants to threaten me with society, with violence over status, whatever, I'm going to submit, and I'm going to say, I'm not having any of it. I don't care. I'm walking away. You're the bigger man. Good for you. Where robbery is a different thing. Let's say it depends. Like if somebody wants my wallet, good for you. I will submit. But if it was a matter of sexual assault, and men certainly do also get sexually assaulted, over there, I'll fight to the death.
Right. So it's a little complicated, right? So on the one hand, what you want is to give the impression to everybody that you would fight to the death over any serious threat, because then you're just not going to pick you. So you're looking around at the people that you might pick to rob, and you look like somebody, if I pull a knife on you and I want your wallet, you'll fight me. You'll with the knife in your throat, you won't give it to me. Well, I don't want to. Then I'm not going to rob you. Let me rob that guy over there who looks like he'll hand over his wallet more easily. And so what you ideally want is to give the impression of being a very hard target to everybody, but then being actually very thoughtful and sensible about when you're actually a hard target and when you're not. And in the case of sexual assault, especially if it's male-female sexual assault, well, humans are sexually dimorphic. Males on average are way bigger and stronger. And so I suspect throughout history, the safest strategy 9 times out of 10, once you get to the point where the assault is happening, is to submit rather than to fight, because you're going to lose and you're going to end up being a lot more damaged than if you didn't fight. And of course, that happens a lot in the case of sexual assault, that rather than fight, it's submit. With that said, if you can look like the person who would fight, but then you're not necessarily, that makes you less likely to be, again, to be chosen as a target in the first place, which would be the optimal circumstance.
Mm. In the context of sexual assault, definitely the strategy of looking like a hard target, looking like you're threatened. But this goes back again. It's not a fight to the death for both sides, right? The person committing the attack, the moment that they chose you because you looked small, but hey, you know how to fight, you know Krav Maga, you know jiu-jitsu, whatever, or maybe you're just your natural instincts, you're going to start scratching and biting and shouting and yelling, and they stop and they go, wait a second, evaluated the situation wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Under the right circumstances, that's super effective. And of course, there's big individual differences in somebody's willingness to do that and ratcheting up the level of conflict. And some people will do it at the very beginning when you just, as you mentioned earlier, when you just first approach me as a potential target and I go, get the hell out of my face, and suddenly you're like, oh, I pegged him as being more soft than that. I'll go say, oh, excuse me. And you move on. And so there's lots of circumstances where drawing attention to the circumstance and doing your best is sufficient. But of course, there's lots and lots of circumstances where it's not, where that will do you no good at all in the current situation that you're in. And then you might naturally do it anyway, but you might also say, you know what, there's nothing to be gained by that. I'll just submit to whatever the nature of this assault is.
I find it's incredibly, incredibly difficult because there's a dynamic here. And if I were to start, let's say, by submissive behaviors, let's say I say, look, in both situations, by the way, in social violence or in predatorial violence, if I started by cooperating or by submission, I said, look, I don't want to fight. Let me buy you a beer. You go, well, I don't want a beer. You're looking at me wrong. Let's step outside. And I said, look, I don't want to step outside. I'm sorry. I'm just going to leave you. The more I'm kind of in a reverse, I'm submission. Now, when I understand that there is no way out, to kind of flip the switch and go from reverse into full throttle is incredibly hard. In sexual assault, same thing. If, and I think there's a certain... I don't know if it's a natural process of the predator, but somebody started following me, right? So I started getting scared and I started walking a bit faster. And then they got in my personal space and I made myself a bit smaller. And then they put their hand on my shoulder and I didn't initially respond because I was afraid. And then they start talking to me. And we start going down this pathway where I'm starting to feel weaker and weaker and weaker. And then by that time, when I understand that my strategy for submitting is like, thing can be a robbery, right? They put a knife to your throat and then they say, give me your wallet. And you gave them the wallet. Now they say, give me your phone. And you give them the phone. And now they say, get in the car. And you get in the car. And now they take you to another location. By that time, forget about the fact that it's much harder to fight. Psychologically, I've gone down this road. I've like committed already to this path of not fighting, that now when I understand that there's no other choice but fighting, it's already too late and it's going to be that much harder for me to fight. But if initially you walked into my personal space and I say, back away, who are you? Don't put your hand on me. It's going to be much easier for me now to understand, okay, I got to fight.
Yeah, part of that I agree with you is totally the mental set. And part of that is actually hormonal responses as well. And if you start getting aggro at somebody when they're grabbing you, your testosterone goes up and you prepare for combat. If you start making yourself smaller and you try to appease, then your testosterone goes down and you're preparing to run away. And as you point out, it's harder to undo that and to strike out because you're in a low T situation versus a high T situation. But it's like everything else. You're making a judgment at the very front end in an ambiguous circumstance. Which of these two strategies is going to be better? And I'd say many times it's unpredictable. You're going to get lucky and choose the right one, or you're going to get unlucky and choose the wrong one, and you're going to make the thing a lot worse than it was going to be.
Mm. So there's one thing that's been troubling me, and I was actually speaking with this with Rory Miller, who's a very, very well-known author and an expert also in self-defense, and we couldn't quite understand road rage, of where that fits in. Because what I find unique about road rage is that it has the capacity to get people to react violently, that in other situations, these people or this profile of person would never act out violently. For example, you know, we can understand that, you know, young 20-something year old males, they're going to bar fight. Like, you're not going to see a 50-year-old man get suckered into a bar fight unless there's something, you know, atypical about them. The older males won't generally participate in status seeking violence and so on. But road rage seems to be able to get, you know, even the most, you know, nicest, socially adept person, or the person the least violent, or even you see like women that, you know, will take on, you know, people bigger than them. There's just something that road rage gets out of people that is completely unexplainable. Do you have a theory?
It is. I don't have a good theory. I would offer a few observations. One of which is that people tend to be somewhat separated from others by the physical space of their car. And so imagine that I'm standing in line at the grocery store and you kind of nudge yourself in front of me. Well, A, you'd be way less likely to do that. And B, I'd be like, you know, what are you? Well, fine, I'll wait one more person. But in a car, if I'm pulling up, you might, even though I'm technically ahead of you, you might see an opportunity to quickly pass me. And that sort of, you would, even though you would never do that in line, you feel more empowered to do that by being separated off in your own physical space. But I also feel more empowered to respond really strongly in a way that I wouldn't do if we were standing there physically together. And so what happens is that there's two things going on. One, we're kind of separated by this glass window and this vehicle that's around us. And so we feel the degree of separation from others, that distance makes us feel somehow empowered to be ruder in the same way we are on the internet, right? That there's this anonymous world where I say something on Facebook and you don't know me, and or Instagram or whatever, any medium that you want, Reddit, and you flame me with these crazy responses you would never say to anybody, even if you don't like them in person, because the distance that's been created on the internet, well, that distance exists in the vehicle. It's not quite as big as it is on the internet, but it still exists. And then the other side of that coin is vehicles are incredibly deadly devices that don't seem like deadly devices. You know, we've evolved to easily develop fear of spiders and snakes because in ancestral environments they could poison us and kill us. But we didn't evolve to fear large moving vehicles or electrical outlets or the things that actually can kill us in today's world. And so we're traveling around in these super dangerous, high speed, very deadly devices that don't feel deadly to us at all. And that also pull a little bit of the version of the internet where they separate us off in space from each other. And so they make us depersonalized to a small degree where we suddenly feel more appropriate to be rude to each other. And then, of course, that escalates really fast because both sides feel that way. In the same way that it escalates really fast on the internet where I'm flaming you and then you do the same thing and suddenly we're, you know, death threatening each other or whatever over some random trivia like you see constantly in social media.
Okay, that makes sense.
My best guess.
Okay, yeah. I think it's a pretty good educated one. Bill, thank you so much for your time. I found this absolutely, absolutely fascinating. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, it's totally my pleasure. It's really a kick.
If people want some more information, your book, The Social Leap, which is brilliant. I just finished that. I highly recommend it. Where else can people find you? Good.
Well, they can find me anywhere on the web. And so there's lots of podcasts. If they just Google my name, Bill von Hippel, that conversations come up and lectures that I've given, public lectures. So I'm very available in that regard. And then, of course, all my research is available for people who want to take a really deep dive into the weeds. And that can be found on Google Scholar or ResearchGate or at their library or any of those places as well.
Except the podcast you gave on Joe Rogan was absolutely brilliant. I really enjoy that one. And
it was fun.
I encourage whoever finishes this one to go over and listen to that one. It was brilliant.
Super.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Bill. I really, really appreciate it.
Totally my pleasure, Ron.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you're feeling especially generous, leave me a rating and a review. The full episode notes are available on ronengelman.com, where you'll find links to what we discussed today and information on how you can train with me and my team in Israel. Stay safe, stay healthy, please stay well, and I'll see you around.